Hi, I'm Shannon Sakosha, Chief Investment Officer here at Boston Private. Thank you for joining us today as we look ahead to the second quarter of 2019. I'm excited to be joined by my colleague, Gerald Baker, our Chief Fiduciary Officer. I've asked Gerald to join me so that we can have a discussion focused on the top five considerations for tax planning, and then we'll discuss how we specifically take these factors into consideration as we work with clients to set up and assess their portfolios here at Boston Private. We're going to start with an outlook and a rewind from what's happened in the fourth quarter. As we saw in the fourth quarter of 2018, we had a very challenging environment. There were three things that really led to that. Number one, the continued lack of resolution as far as the China trade talks. Number two, potential changes in Washington policy with the ascendance of the Democrats to the top of the House. And number three, the fact that the Fed was remaining fairly aggressive in their path towards tightening, which many investors and economists alike felt was probably unnecessary given where we are, where we're from an economic standpoint. The other thing that was happening too, that's a little less US specific, but certainly affects the global economy, is that we were seeing softening not only in China, based in part from the tariff situation with the United States, but also in the European Union and in the UK on the heels of an unresolved Brexit. So with all of that, we were starting to see a lot of softer economic data creeping into the system. What was most notable, however, was what occurred at the very end of December in what was called the Powell pivot. Fed Chairman Powell came out and essentially cited the fact that the Fed was now going to remain patient and data dependent in their path towards tightening. This is really what has resulted in a very nice rally for risk assets in the first quarter of 2019. While much of the decline during the fourth quarter of 2018 had been more pronounced here in the United States, we certainly saw that rebound in the first quarter of 2019 here in the United States as well, with smaller cap stocks, which tend to be a bit more risky, rebounding more than larger cap names. However, we did see positive moves in the international markets as well. Part of that is the fact that with the Fed on hold, the dollar is unlikely to significantly appreciate over the course of this year, which is a tailwind for US investors when investing internationally or in emerging markets. From the bond perspective, we've crested yields that are still somewhat low historically. However, they're attractive enough for people that are looking to sort of become more conservative over the back half of this equity market rally to be able to start to see fixed income as a reasonable alternative, albeit maybe not the yields that you were enjoying 10 or 20 years ago in the bond market. We also saw commodities and REITs perform well. If you think about a late cycle, traditionally commodities do perform well, but that's typically because we're seeing an inflationary environment. As we've closed out the quarter, we have started to see a creep higher in oil prices. You'll see that in the gas pump already this week. Over the last couple of weeks, we've seen those oil prices be reflected there. And so we do expect commodities to continue to remain fairly strong as long as there's evidence that inflation is ticking higher, even if it's at a very modest rate. If we think about it in terms of investors, one of the things that we cited back in the July-August timeframe of last year was that we felt the S&P 500 was somewhat expensive. Following that sharp fourth quarter decline, we've actually seen, with this rebound, valuations back to their previous levels. The other thing that's occurring, though, is that we're seeing earnings actually come in perhaps negative this quarter for the S&P 500 on a year-over-year basis. And so there's been a lot of talk made of what's called a potential earnings recession, whereby we would see earnings growth negative for the S&P 500 in the first quarter and perhaps the second quarter of this year. However, if you think about it in terms of growth and our expectations that we could see GDP grow from between 2 and 2.5% this year, the outlook for sales growth and profit margins are really what's going to be more important. So we would advise investors not to spend too much time thinking about this potential quote-unquote earnings recession over the next two quarters and really focus more on the fact that if the economy remains fairly stable, albeit growing at this somewhat modest pace, we could, you know, see a continued move higher in earnings despite this what we would call blip in the cycle. Driving the gains in the S&P 500 in the first quarter, were technology stocks. So while we saw significant declines in several big technology names in the fourth quarter, they really reasserted their dominance in this first quarter. Other cyclical sectors such as industrials and energy also have responded positively. That's been a little bit different than what we've seen over the last couple of years. those tend to be associated somewhat with the value factor, and we've really seen growth dominate over the last couple of years. So it was nice to see a traditional sort of pro-cyclical rebound here in the first quarter. From an economic perspective, we continue to focus on leading economic indicators. They're still positive, but they have increased at a slower rate over the last several months than they had been previously. That doesn't necessarily point to an impending recession, but it's something that we want to be mindful of, is because it indicates that this modest economic growth is unlikely to accelerate in the next 12 to 18 months. Manufacturing remains in expansionary territory. It was up to about 55.3 according to the ISM for March. That actually was up from 54.2 in February, which was the lowest level in 2 years. So again, if you think about this, all of these are still indicating continued expansion in the economy, but at a slightly lower trend and less growth. From a payroll perspective, much was made up about the February jobs number, which was incredibly low, only 33,000 jobs on the revised number. But the U.S. economy added almost 200,000 jobs again in March, and so the employment picture remains very solid. As for the Fed, as mentioned, we saw that pivot at the end of December. Interestingly, the market is actually starting to price in the chance of a rate cut this year rather than a rate hike. If you go back to the middle of last year, the market was expecting anywhere between 2 and 4 interest rate hikes this year. So to go from that to expectations of a cut, there is certainly part of that is political. There's been a significant amount of political pressure exerted by the administration to continue the more accommodative policy. But from our perspective, there's very little in the economy that's pointing to a rate cut this year. And so we think it's fairly unlikely unless we start to see a significant deceleration in some of the economic data. I'll close with our views on asset allocation. One of the things we did over the course of this quarter, as we spoke about if you listened to our webcast or read our newsletter in the fourth quarter, is that we were looking for an opportunity, as appropriate, to potentially become more conservative in our allocation in 2019. The market has afforded us that opportunity, again, having gotten back to sort of fourth quarter decline valuations, we felt that it made sense for us. We had been overweight in equities for essentially the past decade, which has proved to be the right decision given where we had been post-financial crisis. However, at this point in time, we feel the risks are more balanced. And so rather than continue to make an overweight call in the equity market, we've neutralized our position. We've also incrementally added to our fixed income positioning, and we'll continue to do that over the course of the next couple of years. And so we remain at more of a neutral stance. Drilling down just a little bit more, we are more conservative. We are more conservative in our bond portfolios. We think that there's a move towards increasing quality as we move forward over the next several years. On the equity side, we're also a bit more conservative in that we're favoring large cap stocks over small cap stocks, given the volatility associated with those. We still like international names. Again, with that tailwind of the fact that the dollar is likely to remain stable, we think that that points to potential opportunities for U.S. investors. With that said, Gerald, how do we put these recommendations in practice as we construct portfolios? But more importantly, in the near term, you know, we're basically done with filing taxes. Well, many people are, or have at least filed their extensions.
Exactly.
So, you know, as we think about portfolio construction, but more importantly, you know, as we think about planning for 2020, what are some themes and considerations that you're working on that then start to inform how we incorporate some of this investment advice into our portfolios?
Well, Shannon, when we're working with our clients, you know, they're coming to us with a lot of questions, of course, about market performance, equities, fixed income. But then they're also asking us, a lot's happened in the past year with tax reform that was enacted in 2018, and how does that impact their portfolio? But importantly, how does that impact their tax and estate planning strategies? So what we're really starting with are some very basic principles with our clients. First off, how much are you withholding? Have you actually looked at your statements and your pay stubs and really figured out, do you have the correct withholdings? Have you designated appropriately? So what I think a lot of people have found, and what we've definitely heard on the news over the past 4 or 5 months as people have been rushing to file their taxes under this new legislation of, I'm not getting back as much money as I thought I would, or I'm owing more taxes than I typically have in the past. So one of the sort of baseline things that we're starting with our clients is, have you really talked with your tax advisor about, are you withholding appropriately? So that's sort of a baseline a focus for all of our clients and for all of our practitioners. But then from there, what we're really looking at and having sitting down and having conversations with our clients with is the new federal exemption of $11.4 million can lull certain people into a sense of security of, oh, I don't have a taxable estate at my passing, so I don't need to worry about setting up a trust, making sure that it's funded. You know, probate, I can deal with the additional administrative expenses that and time that's associated with it. So what's really in it for me? What people seem to forget is there are a lot of higher earners in certain states that still have estate taxes. Massachusetts, New York, to name just a couple. So when you're looking at setting up, you know, your tax strategy, both during your lifetime, you're also wanting to be looking at how does it dovetail into your estate plan. So it really hasn't changed the paradigm through which you need to be thinking about your estate planning and tax efficiency strategy going forward. So what we're looking at with clients is, do you have assets that have appreciated considerably over the past decade or two? And what are ways that you can get those out of your estate today? So for instance, if you owned an investment, a piece of investment real estate that you paid $250,000 for 10 years ago, now worth $10 million, or $2 million. Let's further assume that there's no depreciation capture on the property that would be recognized in the year of the sale, regardless of whether there's principal payments are made. Finally, let's assume that you sell the real estate to a non-grantor trust for the benefit of your children in exchange for a 20-year interest-only note that the trust sells the property for $2.5 million a couple years later. The current favorable long-term tax capital gain rates remain in effect in the year of the sale by the trust. The trust would have a $2.25 million in long-term capital gains, which would result in a $337,500 federal income tax to the trust. Since the asset was held by the trust for more than a couple of years, you can defer the gain on the original sale until the principal payment of $2 million is made in X number of years, paying tax only on the interest income received. The trust can then invest the net after-tax proceeds of $2.16 million from the sale and use the proceeds for the benefit of the children. This is a technique that works particularly well if assets appreciate at a rate in excess of the interest being paid on the note. Moreover, any future appreciation is removed from your estate at your death. Although the present value of the note is included in your estate, if you die, it is repaid. That's a great way to funnel, you know, potential gains and defer them down the road, but also get them taxed at a very advantageous rate. So again, though you have a much higher federal threshold than in prior years, there is a lot that can be done to mitigate both your capital gains exposure, your income tax exposure during your lifetime, and also take into consideration your estate tax at the state level. So again, let's use Massachusetts as an example for estate tax purposes. The threshold is $1 million. It's particularly low. It's just over $5 million in New York. But in Massachusetts, it's $1 million. So anything above that $1 million is going to be taxed at the Massachusetts estate tax rate, resulting in a considerable expense. The other thing to consider here is that from an administration standpoint, your family is going to have to engage with CPAs. They're going to have to engage with estate tax attorneys, estate planning attorneys, to make sure that the taxes are being paid and delegated, allocated accordingly. The main focus that we are really drilling home to our clients when we're looking at estate planning, when we're looking at tax planning, is you want to mitigate gains during your lifetime. You want to mitigate death and transfer taxes at your passing. Those are sort of the cornerstones of what our practice has always been, and those haven't changed with the tax reform. And I would say that's the biggest hot topic for 2019 into 2020 planning.
So when I think about, you know, how do we put these recommendations into practice as we construct our portfolios, and how do we marry the fact that, to your point, you know, we're at the end of this cycle where there has been significant appreciation in these holdings. How challenging is it for you to, you know, have our clients recognize that these types of solutions are necessary and appropriate? And, you know, how do you interface, you know, with our team to be able to drive those recommendations home?
You know, it's a really good question, Shannon, because again, you know, as I sort of started the chat or touched on tangentially, people have been lulled into a false sense of security of, oh, we have a high federal exemption, we don't need to worry about estate taxes, ergo, just worry about managing my portfolio, maybe put my spouse or my children on as payable on death for the account, and everything will be fine. But the embedded gains due to the performance of the equity markets over the past decade or so have really caused a false sense of comfort as well, and oh, I've got all this money, I don't need to worry about how it's transferred, how I allocate it out. You still have to deal with gains. And that's kind of what I was trying to give with the example of the real property that's appreciated, that's held for about a decade or so. You want to avoid paying unnecessary taxes whenever possible, right? A good tax strategy, a good tax advice is be cost efficient with what you're doing with the gains and appreciation of the assets that you have invested or that you own. And what we are really trying to focus on with clients is look at your portfolios, tell us what your next phase is. Are you looking to rebalance? If you're looking to you have a client, Shannon, that's looking to rebalance out of equities, move into a more defensive position as they, you know, anticipate potential market volatility, whether that's valid or not is a different issue, but we see clients as they start to approach a different phase in their lives, as they're approaching retirement. Had a conversation with one last week looking to deleverage some of the risk in their portfolio, there were going to be considerable realized gains. So one of the things that we talked about was setting up an irrevocable non-grantor trust, where they would be gifting the assets into that trust. The gains would then be incurred by that trust at a lower rate. The biggest challenge with that concept is they're surrendering control in ownership, right? So what we're really working with clients on is counseling them, and if you have a portfolio of a certain size of marketable securities, of commercial and residential real estate, what are your income streams? What do you need for this phase that you're entering that's causing you to look at deleveraging some of your risk in your portfolio of marketable securities? And what can we do to mitigate any of the gains that you would potentially realize? And do you have sufficient income stream and other assets to live off of that the assets that would be realizing these significant gains wouldn't be an issue for you to gift into an irrevocable non-grantor trust for the benefit of, let's say, your children or your nieces and nephews, or even contributing them to a charitable trust to accommodate your charitable endeavors. So we're really trying to focus on getting our clients to look more broadly at what is their tax strategy? How do you make that as efficient as possible as they are looking at various phases of their lives? Of course, that's one microcosm of our client set, right? We have clients that are not changing, looking to retire and starting to plan succession planning of their assets. For those clients, we would really be focusing on what are your payroll tax liabilities? Are you looking at your withholdings appropriately? Are there assets that are appreciating significantly that can be put into a trust now that you wouldn't need to be relying on? But again, that's where we're looking at what are clients' streams of income, what is their portfolio look like, what are their objectives based on what phase they are in their lives. Clearly, an irrevocable non-grantor trust isn't going to be something we would be recommending to somebody in the wealth generation phase of their life, right?
Correct. So one of the things that I would state and I would add, and what's so critical for us is that, you know, we understand and acknowledge that our clients have a lot of different partners and advisors that work with them. But I think having, you know, from the investment standpoint, in many cases, much of our decision making is contingent on some sort of capital gains budget or a budget that's provided to us that is in essence based on tax planning. And so I think that in thinking about how, you know, we construct portfolios, it's not dissimilar to what you've just talked about. It's, you know, balancing, you know, minimizing taxes along with maximizing income as necessary and making sure that we're also reflecting our best thinking from an asset allocation perspective in those portfolios. So we don't want the tail to wag the dog. If you go back to 2006 and 2007, you know, if you had been a traditional 60-40 investor coming out of the dot-com bubble bursting and you had, you know, invested in a 60-40 portfolio then, you were significantly overweight in equities by the time the 2008 recession hit. And that was a difficult position, to your point, you know, especially if you were in a trust and you would just sort of let these assets appreciate and you didn't want to, you know, pay those taxes. And so I think it's really critical, even if you have an outside advisor, you know, that you have sort of a holistic wealth manager looking at the, you know, the suite of strategies that are available in order to mitigate your taxes, in order to potentially decrease what you're paying, but also to make sure that your portfolio isn't being allowed to creep outside of, you know, the ideal allocation just because you're holding to what a capital gains budget that could be inconsistent with where we are in the market cycle.
You're spot on with that, Shannon, and that's one of the things that I think is a unique value proposition in our organization of getting to work together, is that we're partnering together to look at it from the investment standpoint, but also looking at it from the tax liability and the estate planning standpoint to make that sure that our clients are very well positioned with a full array of viewpoints. And we typically work closely together to coordinate those viewpoints for the benefit of our clients. But then we're also able to work closely with their outside tax advisors and their estate planning counsel to really ensure, to your point, a holistic view of their entire portfolio picture and their asset mix and tax liability as a whole.
One of the things that we've always said is it's a combination of both asset allocation and asset location. You know, you're going to have an overall asset allocation that you want to make sure that you're meeting your goals and needs at the end. But however, where you locate those assets, there's a lot of flexibility, and there's definitely ways that you can construct an overall portfolio with not having each, you know, actual account look exactly the same.
Exactly. Exactly. So.
Well, with that, we thank you for listening in. We hope that you found this perspective helpful.
Listen, you have any questions following up from this today, you can always reach out to your wealth advisor, to Shannon, to myself. We are here to help you figure out a way to implement some of the most efficient tactics possible to mitigate your tax liability.
And I welcome any thoughts or questions that you may have. You may find me on Twitter at Shannon Sakosha. And that's it for our Q2 Outlook. We look forward to speaking with you in July as we discuss another topic of interest as well as our outlook for the rest of the year. Thank you.
Thank you.